two petitioners in this action in the habeas corpus. This is a continuation of the Mann-Minn fiasco that befell Nebraska in June 2014 as a result of an Omaha World Herald story. I was the attorney for Keena Jackson, who I argued 11 months ago, and in that particular case, when the court entered its order, it said that Mr. Jackson's remedy was not through a direct appeal of the actions taken by the Lancaster County District Court, but was through habeas corpus. On these two cases, that's the habeas corpus that was taken. However, Judge Colburn, in both cases, on procedural grounds, refused to conduct an evidentiary hearing. So I think based solely upon the Keena Jackson's case, the case needs to be remanded under the holding of Jackson that habeas corpus is the appropriate remedy for an evidentiary hearing. That doesn't solve the case, though.
What would the evidentiary hearing decide?
That's exactly my point here. The question is, what kind of hearing does he get? And in that regards, I think that one of the things that needs to be established is whether or not the state waived its jurisdiction over Mr. Alameen and Mr. Evans by the issuance of the unconditional discharge. Now, the reason this gets complicated is because the state filed an affidavit alleging in just one paragraph that his prior release was erroneous. They don't explain how that erroneous release took place. Even in the Anderson case that I think the judge that is referred to in the things that we submitted in support of summary judgment, in that case you recognize that there were, I think, three different methods by which you can address what is referred to as an erroneous discharge. One of the ways is whether the state, by its action, has waived jurisdiction. Simple negligence doesn't cut it, and I agree with that. Simple negligence on the part of the Department of Correctional Services or some clerk or some, as in Anderson, where it was a sheriff's deputy who misread the judge's order, I have absolutely no problem with the Anderson case. This is not the Anderson case. Now, one of the functions of oral argument, I think, is to provide you with the context of this case, how it fits into everything else that's happened. And when I argued the Keena Jackson case, I said there is no case like this. Well, I was wrong. There are three other cases that have come up like this since I argued that case, two of them out of Nebraska. One of them involves the Department of Correctional Services miscalculating the discharge date on DWIs, assuming there was a mandatory minimum, and then later on deciding, whoops, we made a mistake. So there are a large number of inmates who gave the state a pound of flesh contrary to the statutes in effect. That was similar type of case number two, number two, I guess. Number three is, again, from the state of Nebraska, where around December, about Thanksgiving of this year, they announced that they had totally screwed up calculating LB 191 discharge, and there's over 500 inmates who gave the state more time than they were owed, and another, I think, 700, I'm not sure the exact number, who they say owe the state more money. At least one of those individuals was also under the Mann-Minn case that I'm here. He was released under a Mann-Minn. They pulled him back in, gave him some parole time, discharged him off parole, and now he has a second certificate of discharge showing that that one is also invalid. And if you accept what Mr. Love says, both of those are void ab initio. He's walking around with two certificates of discharge, neither of which, according to Mr. Love, is valid. My point is that if I'm going to have an evidentiary here, it should include the sequence of events that went into this erroneous discharge. And
you mean to establish that they've waived any rights?
Exactly. This isn't some clerk who screwed up. This was a policy that started in 1994. It involves an attorney general's opinion by now Federal Judge Lori Smith Camp in 1996. It involves repeated emails and communications between Ron Reifmuller wrote the policy in 1996. It involves repeated emails, seminars, discussions with district court judges, telling those district court judges this is the official policy of the Department of Correctional Services. This is how we compute mandatory minimum. And those judges, relying upon the statement of the official policy, fashioned their sentencing. And in fact, these two individuals have 10 to 15 habitual criminal sentences. One of the examples, and included in the materials that we tried to offer, uses that same example. That if you have a 10 to 15, it means 10-year man, 10-year discharge. The judges, I think, relied upon that. And the reason you would not give a guy a 10 to 10, you would give him a 10 to 5, is you have that extra 5 years hanging over his head in the event that he loses good time in prison.
You give him 5 to 10, not 10 to 5.
You're given the corrections, the ability to pull his good time. Billy Roy Tyler comes to mind. So that a 10 to 10, while you have a jam date of 10 years, if you lose all your good time, you can do 15. So I don't think that's a bad policy on part of the judges, but you're not expecting when you sentence someone to a 10 to 15 that he's going to have to do 15 or 12 and a half if good time only applies on the back end, because that's what you've been told.
You've been told that when good time can kick in. Is that what you're referring to?
The district judge has been told when good time can kick in. And then on top of all that, every single inmate who gets sentenced like that gets his dream sheet from the Department of Correctional Services saying exactly what I said and what the judges said. So I think that becomes a waiver. Now here's my problem, Justice Wright, regarding trying to limit that habeas hearing. And the analogy that I use would be if this court says, yeah, you're right, go back and have a hearing. And it would be like the driver on the side of the road who's out of gas and the Texaco tanker truck pulls up. The Texaco tanker guy says, well, I can't get any gas out of here, but there's a gas station down the road half a mile. You need to go down there. At the same time, that tanker driver knows that gas station hasn't sold gas for 150 years. This is the most unusual situation in which I need the opportunity to present evidence to rebut the affidavit that was filed by Mr. Kinney. And I would agree with you that this would be similar had Mr. Kinney set out in his affidavit all of the reasons and facts as to why this was erroneous. But he didn't do that. That's the problem. If he would have set out, we had an official policy developed in 1996, Reifmuller had a memorandum, we sent letters to all these judges, on and on and on, we screwed up Castillas, we didn't.
Did your habeas petition, did you mention or allege a waiver?
Absolutely. I cite Shields v. Obedo.
That was before the district judge went
down. It was before the district court, absolutely. It was waiver. I said it's waiver. I said it twice. I think it's in ground two. But it's in my petition.
And so what was the basis of his opinion that...
The basis of Judge Colbert...
That he could grant the waiver would be a factual issue, would it not?
I believe so.
Okay, so what was his rationale?
That you can't get there from through a habeas corpus. He ruled directly contrary to Keenan Jackson. He never even gave me any merit. He didn't allow me any discovery. We had dueling motions for summary judgment. He granted the state's motion for summary judgment saying that habeas corpus wasn't available to raise this kind of an issue. And my whole point is that...
Well, not take words out of your mouth, but the waiver would be based upon the fact that he no longer was incarcerated under proper sentence, right?
That he had been discharged, and the actions by the Department of Correctional Services constituted under due process and under anything you could imagine an intentional action on their part.
A waiver.
Relinquished jurisdiction.
A waiver of it, and so he's then being held illegally.
And he's held illegally.
Yeah, that's the key point.
The key key point, he's been held illegally because they issued a certificate of discharge. I would agree that if he got that certificate of discharge through his own misconduct, he can't benefit from that. But nobody is complaining any of these inmates did anything wrong.
Is there another theory that the state can adopt besides a waiver theory? That,
you mean me?
Well, that the state could say was that instead of a waiver, you've been allowed good time credit for the time you've been out. That's the relief you're entitled to.
Well, they gave him no notice of that. I mean,
I understand. I understand there's no notice of that.
If he is still technically in custody and he went to visit his sister in Oklahoma, then he's left the state while leaving. I mean, I understand that in certain cases that's appropriate, but I think it is only appropriate in cases where the erroneous discharge on an individual basis is based upon negligence by somebody in the system. But I think where you have an affirmative policy in existence and you have the kind of factual record that I submitted in support of the motion for summary judgment, I ought to get a full-blown hearing on whether the state waived jurisdiction.
Well, suppose by the time the case is decided here that the party has served all of his time required and he is entitled to a mandatory discharge date, what remedy does that person have in the case?
He's SOL. He's out of luck. Okay. And I hate that.
Well, and there's one of them that's pretty close, isn't there, right now?
Well, no. I can tell you what happened. The record is when I fought, or not the record, I filed four of these in Douglas County. The Douglas County judges refused to even issue an order to show cause. I was not able to perfect those cases. And those individuals contradict what's in the record regarding them only arresting people who were owed the state more than a year. Justin Wallace, Robert Trosper, these other guys owed them, like, according to them, 6 or 7 months. One of them, like, 9 months. And what the district county court judges in Douglas County would do is they just wouldn't issue an order to show cause. Those left would sit there for 9 months until they jammed out. So I'm having a real hard time moving this case as fast as I'd like to move this case. But I don't think that that ought to be a determining factor of whether these guys' rights were violated.
I'm trying to... You're saying there's other cases out there and they're just going to be timed out and the issue will...
They're pretty well timed out now. Okay. They're already timed
right.
out.
Right, but in these matters, the parties are paroled and they're... subject to limitations.
Well,
civil limitations.
I don't want to shoot myself in the foot, but okay. They both, under the state's theory, would jam out middle of the summer sometime.
Okay.
And but I don't think that should be a consideration. I mean, what's wrong is wrong, and what's right is right.
Right.
What
and you'd to like to get the wrong. Issue formed and get some.
Well,
comment
I mean, the issue is still active as long as they haven't exceeded their mandatory discharge dates.
That's right. And I can give you the second problem, Judge, right? And it is that I could have tried to go over to federal court, but I can't get into federal court until I exhaust my state remedies. And if I'm gonna lose, and this is nobody's gonna talk it, I mean the sooner I get that, the better off I am. But I couldn't have done that a year ago. I couldn't have gone over to federal court because he'd say send it back, give me a state court.
And after Jackson, try a habeas.
Pardon me?
And after Jackson, try a habeas.
Yeah, and Jackson...
That you've been advised that may well be your path.
Yes, and okay. But I already had that in place with these two individuals.
Thank you.
But I could not get it in place with Jackson, and it's a waste of time with him because it's a waste of time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Love. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, George Love, on behalf of the Appellee of the State of Nebraska. I'm not really sure what the argument here is I get to sue everybody under a writ of habeas corpus. I would respectfully submit to the Court what's before this Court. Two cases involving two prisoners that were erroneously released early. With respect to what happened in Douglas County, with respect to I would sue this way, with respect to I want to sue everybody, with respect to the Department of Corrections, I want to sit down. That's not before this Court. That's all irrelevant. On the he cross-appealed on a motion for summary judgment and lost. There are no facts in dispute here. These two men were released erroneously, but early. They hadn't completed their sentence. The court in Anderson, as I argued in brief, at least in my view, has adopted the equitable doctrine theory out of the three possible theories that courts use to address these particular problems. Mr. Soucy wants to sue the state and the Department of Corrections. He can bring a 1983 action. This isn't the place to do it. He can't litigate everyone's rights within the context of this habeas. That's what 83 is for, 1983 is for. So I would respectfully submit to the court.
Well, I think he's only wanting to litigate his two clients.
No, he's wanting to litigate whether it was incorrect for the Department of Corrections to do this and their policies over the past 10 or 15 years.
As it applies to his two clients.
Pardon me?
As it applies to his two clients.
But what remedy is there under a writ of habeas?
I beg your pardon. I think what he said is he's trying to make a record that would establish a waiver. Isn't that the substance of the argument?
And I would submit to you that that's irrelevant. That's collateral. The issue is whether the sentence and the judgment in this case, in Alameen's and Evans' case, are valid. And if they are it's over.
In the habeas corpus.
In the context of this court's 100 years of decisions on habeas corpus.
You have to show he's been held illegally, right?
Correct.
And your claim is they're not held illegally because they hadn't finished the sentence that
was imposed.
Is that the...
In other words, yes, Your Honor, it is.
How does that square with our Jackson opinion?
I'm sorry?
How does that square
with our Jackson opinion? I am not familiar with what that decision says. I'm sorry, I don't know. But I would say that Anderson applies here, and as I've argued in brief. And given the law of habeas corpus in this state being a very limited remedy, this idea that you can bring in the entire Department of Corrections records to establish a collateral matter as to this particular individual's, the validity of this particular individual's sentence, it's collateral. It's irrelevant.
You're going back to the creation. If the initial sentence was okay, that's
correct. That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying all of that, none of that, would show that sentence is invalid. It's collateral. It's irrelevant.
So, would either of these defendants have any option whatsoever to contest the fact that they have been brought back into the prison system?
The answer is yes. They've done it by habeas corpus. In other words, the basic position, as I understand the defendants, is I was discharged, I'm free, you can't rearrest me, I have a certificate of discharge, therefore you are holding me illegally.
Are they resentenced?
Pardon me?
Were they resentenced?
No. Only
one of the legal questions is whether or not the Department of Corrections can make its own determination as to what the length of the sentence should be and how the good time is factored into the determination of what your parole date is and what your mandatory discharge date is.
That has been a function of the Department of Corrections in terms of when an individual is sentenced, is applying the law and the good time and so on and so forth. Good time statutorily applied by the Department of Corrections, and the fact that they made a mistake,
error was generally made because they were giving credit for good time on mandatory minimum sentences.
That's correct, and they shouldn't have been doing that. That was the law all along, and that's the mistake. Now, whether or not all of that, I want to call it collateral, it doesn't matter.
I mean, is there a question between the two powers, the one, the Department of Corrections under the executive branch, and the power of the court to determine what the sentence is, and that the executive branch can then determine, oh, we aren't going to give you that sentence, we're going to give you what we think it should be? Is that an underlying question in this case?
Well, I don't know that it's an underlying question. I think it's a resolved question in the sense that I don't think the Department of Corrections believes that it can usurp the court's authority and calculate a sentence differently than what was imposed.
Well, I think that's implied in the defendant's argument.
I don't think they have the authority to do that per se. Their statutory duty comes from statute.
They can't make a waiver if they don't have authority to do it.
That's correct. Otherwise, no court's order would be valid. They, on terms of sentencing, they could discharge people whenever they felt like it, and it wouldn't matter. And that's the point. So is there a separation of powers argument? Yeah, potentially I can see that if somebody would want to make that argument, but that's not what occurred here. I think the Department of Corrections found out, oops, we did this wrong, and is attempting to enforce the court's original sentencing order. That's what's going on here. So I don't think there's a tension
well,
in
does
that
Anderson
sense.
Well, come into this at all?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Does Anderson come into this at all?
I do. I think Anderson does, because I think the court rejected the
other. So under Anderson, would you have a hearing on the facts?
The answer is I don't think so, and the reason is twofold. One, I think the court adopted the equitable doctrine in Anderson approach, which was exactly what happened here.
If you're going to have a hearing on equity, don't you have to get to the facts?
But there's no facts in dispute here. And then you have to take Anderson and put it within the context of the law of habeas in this state. So what happened? A mistake. Sentence wasn't executed properly. The person was rearrested and is having to fulfill the original sentence. So, under the law of habeas,
if the sentence is still valid, it's still...
That's right. Basically, we're...
There's nothing illegal about him being held.
Illegal about...
There's nothing illegal about him being held.
No.
So there's no habeas corpus.
No, because the original sentence was imposed, but again, a mistake. It was not executed properly. In other words, the judgment of sentence is not satisfied. It would be, I guess, in an analogy, if you had a $100,000 judgment against somebody and they paid $75,000 and somebody issued a satisfaction of judgment, well, there's something wrong here. There's still $25,000 owed on the judgment. It's the same general idea that the sentencing order is a judgment. And that has to be executed or completed, and that's what's going on here. So I think all of the extraneous about the policy and all of that doesn't matter. It's irrelevant in the context of habeas. It doesn't matter. It may be a nice 42 U.S.C. 1983 action, but it has nothing to do with these two gentlemen. So we would ask that you affirm the district court's orders in each case with respect to finding that there was a mistake by the Department of Corrections, that the sentence imposed had not been validly served, and that the court's original order was entitled to be executed. There are no further questions. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments. For today, the court is adjourned and you are excused.
Thank you.